Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan on News Talk.
Just a warning that this next conversation references sensitive topics that some listeners may find upsetting. We're talking about domestic violence, suicide, coercive control as well. If you've been listening to Lunchtime Live this week, you'll know we've been discussing barring orders, protection orders, safety orders. How difficult are they to obtain? These are the rulings available to victims of domestic violence in this country. And on Tuesday, we spoke to one listener, Donna, who got in touch, who bravely talked about her own experience in trying to obtain a safety order against her former partner.
Well, in my particular case, by the time I went to look for a protection order, I couldn't even articulate why I needed a protection order. I was so sleep deprived. I'd been married. I'd been with my husband for 20 odd years, and we had a large family together. But all I could explain was that the children, I feared that he was going to kill me and he was going to kill the children. So I went into Dolphin House. I remember checking a checklist from Women's Aid. I think there were 13 things on the list, and the only thing on that list that he wasn't trying to do was to deport me, because I was born here. So it was the only thing really that he couldn't do. But everything else on the list, much as I was still minimising it because I was terrified, and I was terrified that he would think I didn't love him, and I was the fear of actually speaking out about what was going on in our house and the shame for myself and for the children, because I knew there would be repercussions.
That's just one part of Donna's conversation with us here on Lunchtime Live on Tuesday. She didn't obtain a safety order, but we did yesterday speak to Sissy. They're an organisation that supports women who are survivors of intimate partner abuse, and to find out whether these orders are actually fit for purpose, but to get a better sense of how they're actually given out and why in some cases they aren't, we sent our reporter Sarah Madden down to the family courts to really watch and observe the system as it works. Sarah's with me here in studio today. Good afternoon, Sarah.
Good afternoon, Andrea.
So just tell us where you've been this week and what exactly did you see?
Yes, so I have been down to the District Family Courts in Dublin. The Dolphin House is what it's called in Temple Bar, the place where your listener Donna had gone. Now, that's where the Emergency Domestic Violent Court sits every week. That's kind of what it's colloquially termed as. This court is in camera. So for those listening, that means that there's no recording allowed there whatsoever. But because obviously in Ireland we have freedom of press, I was allowed to sit in and take notes. Now, that said, I will not be giving out any information in this report that might identify claimants or respondents for obviously their protection and of course their privacy. Now, you spoke about it earlier this week, but just to bring listeners up to speed, the rulings made at this court are ex parte. So that means that just one of the two parties involved will have been present. There is the petitioner, who is the person applying for an order. Now, they don't need to make an appointment. They can just show up. They can fill out an application form before 3:30 p.m. and they will be seen by a judge that very day. Now, that judge only has the power to grant a temporary court order. That might be a protection order or an interim barring order. In the case of an interim barring order, that will only last for up to 8 days, and that forces the respondent to leave the family home, the respondent being the alleged abuser, to leave the family home. It prohibits them from returning. It bans them from using violence, threatening or contacting the applicant or indeed any children that might be in that household. The second is the protection order. Now, that can last for up to 3 months or until the hearing date, where both parties are invited to be present. With a protection order, the respondent is prohibited from intimidating, from threatening or using violence, from molesting or communicating with, watching or besetting the petitioner's place of work or home, unless the two of them live together. So the judge does have amendments that they can make to the terms of these protection orders. For example, if two people have shared children, they may need to communicate, but the judge can outline, you know, it can only happen on WhatsApp and it has to be civil. It has to be to do with the children. So once an order is granted, the petitioner's local Garda station will be sent that order, but it will only come into effect once it's served upon the respondent. And any breaches of that order can then result in arrest or prosecution. Now, on the date of the hearing, that order will expire and it can either be replaced with a safety order that makes those terms more permanent for up to 5 years, or indeed a barring order could be issued. And if that's given out, it is valid for a period of up to 3 years.
Yeah, so the guards will basically serve this order on the, they will have to find the person, I suppose, that's to get the order and they serve it.
They will. And indeed, in some of the courts that I sat in on, the register will actually tell the applicant to let the guards know where they work, where they're residing, even where they drink, to get those orders to be served as soon as is possible.
Okay. And then, like, in as much detail as you can give, Sarah, what did you witness in the emergency domestic courts?
Well, the first thing to note, Andrea, is to get from here where we are in Marconi House in Dublin to Dolphin House, I actually had to go down Love Lane. And the irony was not lost on me after I spent the next couple of hours listening to every kind of way a love story can go wrong. And in fact, one of the judges I spoke to told me that to ensure you don't end up in Dolphin House, the only way to do so is not to get into a relationship at all. The first applicant I witnessed was made by a middle-aged man. He was seeking a protection order from his fiancée, who had chased him down the driveway with a kitchen knife, eventually stabbing him and barely missing his heart. So he limped into the courtroom, actually. He had been escorted by Gardaí. The judge wanted reassurance before she gave out the protection order that the wedding was off, and he said that it was. Then the next person who came in was a woman in her 20s. Again, she was escorted by a ban garda. She was seeking a protection order, actually, against her former girlfriend, who she claims had been psychologically abusing her. Some of the details of this were really quite harrowing. She said that her former girlfriend wasn't letting her shave. She had shown sexual videos of her to friends and to family, and she was harassing her from various fake online profiles, calling her from all sorts of different private numbers. Now, just before lunch, a young woman came in. She was shaking visibly. She was very tearful. Her ex-partner had taken to watching her at work. He was following her home. He had actually started sleeping on the floor outside of her flat. And she was in the court because that very morning at 6:45 a.m., he had beaten the door of her apartment down. She was pushed to the ground by him. She was thrown against the wall. So that's just a sampling, Andrea. It was a really busy morning for the judge, but apparently that's what family courts have come to expect, as family law solicitor Keith Walsh told me.
They're extremely busy. The number of people applying for domestic violence has increased by between 20 and 25% since pre-COVID. In 2019, for all the domestic violence type orders, 20,000 applications were made. And then in 2024, 25,000 applications were made. The rates of granting of protection orders, which prevent the person causing you or the children potentially harm or fear, the rates for the granting of those are between 80 and 90%, which is quite high when you consider the court only hears one side of the argument. And then when they come back for both sides to be heard, the granting rate drops to about 30 to 40%. So you can see it's much less when both sides are heard. But quite often, and I suppose the statistics don't capture this, quite often those cases aren't contested because the people come to some agreement, or one person maybe agrees to move out. So the smaller percentage of granting of those orders could reflect the fact that actually those are probably agreed.
It does seem as though it's more difficult to get an interim barring order and a barring order in comparison to getting a protection order and a safety order. Are there issues around people accessing the likes of barring orders, or why is it more difficult?
It's more difficult because the law makes it more difficult, because it's such a big thing to have somebody removed from the house that they live in. So it has to be a much more serious and immediate threat to somebody's safety, such a threat that the person cannot continue to live in the same house. So that's why it's more difficult to get a barring order.
So that's solicitor Keith Walsh that you were talking to, Sarah. So, and like, I suppose what we can hear even from chatting to you today and listening to Keith, there is obviously a much higher threshold for interim barring orders then.
Definitely. So of the 2,129 interim barring order applications that were made in 2024, only 56% of those were granted. And then at the hearing for a full barring order, which, as I said, can last up to 3 years, less than 28% of those were granted. Now, of course, the judge does have to weigh up the safety of the applicant with the property rights of the respondent. So that's definitely a bit more tricky from a legal standpoint. And actually, the morning that I was there in Dolphin Dolphin House, not one of the interim barring orders that was applied for was granted. Well, the one of the ones that was sought out, though, was from a man, and it was against his former partner. They're still living together, and he claims that she's using the apartment for drink and for drugs. She's inviting people back. He doesn't feel safe. And though he said he's blocking his bedroom door with weights to keep her and her friends out, the judge wasn't satisfied that she was an immediate danger to him. So that wasn't granted. Now, there does seem to be a certain amount of confusion amongst applicants about what actually are legitimate grounds for these orders. So when I was there, the judge repeatedly had to remind those present that they were not there to adjudicate on interpersonal issues or indeed on co-parenting disagreements. For example, there was an exasperated mother in. She was in her 30s. She told the judge her son was being led astray by his father, who she's estranged from. She blames him from the teenager's recent school absenteeism. Again, the judge said a protection order wasn't relevant in that case. Or in another one where a man claimed his ex-partner had become difficult, non-cooperative regarding their children since he's gotten into a new relationship. Now, he accepted the ruling, but he did tell the judge a little peace would be nice.
So there seems to be a lot of men in seeking protection orders when you were there.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. In fact, exactly half of those petitioning the court when I was there were male, which is quite a large number, and it isn't what I expected at all. Now, in some cases, and I will say this, I got the sense that there was a bit of tit for tat going on. Like, for example, there was a male petitioner there who was making an application in retaliation, let's say, for an order that was previously made against him. And I spoke to one of the court officials, a court source who obviously in this case will remain nameless. He confirmed my suspicion. He actually has a name for these. He calls them revenge applications. He explained applicants may be tactically making a paper trail for other actions down the line, or in fact, they may be trying to muddy the water for the judge who will eventually sit in on the safety order hearing. Now, that said, there were definitely what appeared to me to be legitimate applications as well. There was one man who is still living in the marital home. He said his former spouse has a key and she has locked him out of every room in the house, bar the living room where he has to sleep, he has to eat. She won't let him use the bathroom, even to brush his teeth. He actually spoke of cruel notes that she was leaving around the house that he says she is encouraging him to take his own life. She's calling him a pervert, even a paedophile. And actually, when the judge pushed him on why she would use terms like that, he paused before confessing he was actually a child sex abuse survivor. And his former spouse obviously knows that. So she's just trying to torment him. I spoke with Carl Heller. He is from Men's Aid. He works in Dolphin House in the office they have there. And he said they're busier supporting male domestic abuse survivors than ever before.
The numbers of people are engaging absolutely are increasing. The figures of people engaging with my office have increased 10% year on year for the last 3 years. So on average there, I'm meeting 50 people per month and just over 500 people a year. The number is rising all the time. It's a broad cross-section of society. I meet very young men and I meet much older men, men up to their late 80s and indeed up to their 90s, and young men back down as far as 18 years of age. The median age of men I'm meeting is 45, but the largest group is possibly in the 60 years age range. 30% of the male victim will talk about severe abuse, stabbings, very serious assault. About 70% of the men I meet then would fall in under the heading of psychological emotional abuse. Certainly there's some worrying trends, suggestions, allegations by the men around issues like having to be in the house at a certain time, having to produce the phone to account for their movements, who they were talking to and so on during the day, having to account for mileage on the car. And then more disturbingly is the online behaviours. We call it no name, just shame. The male victim may find himself being uploaded or viewing by the general public of certain social media platforms in relation to a relationship that they've just come from, and they may be seen to be spoken about in negative ways, or they may be seen to be threatened. But names are never mentioned. These are all the precursors, if you like, to the man going into the courtroom and making the application.
Just Carl Heller from Men's Aid there. Do we know, Sarah, how many applications are made by men in comparison to women, or even how likely, you know, one is to be granted over the other?
Yeah, no, we don't. I did look into that. The data that we have that Keith Walsh spoke about earlier, it's not broken down at all. It's not broken down into sex. It's not broken down by age, sexuality, socioeconomic group. But that is one area that domestic violence, people who work in this area are looking for better collection of data. They want that to be prioritised. Now, there may still be some barriers in terms of stigma to men also seeking help, seeking support from the courts. One man who was in court the day I was there discussed the shame he felt for having to seek help. Another said he felt like less of a man for being there in court that day. But it really is important to say, Andrea, that when it comes to domestic violence in general, women are the overwhelming majority of those who are likely to be victimised by it. I'm just reporting here on my anecdotal observations, of course. But there were other things I observed as well, like, for example, how the housing crisis is playing into what's happening in Dolphin House, you know, in intimate partner relationships, of course, but also in parent and adult child dynamics as well. In one of the courts I sat in on, there was a really kind of unremarkable man. He was in his 20s and he actually had to take an undertaking in the court not to intimidate, to threaten or to molest his mother for a period of 18 months. His mother was in court and she didn't look up once during his oath. There were also a significant number of cases where the petitioner and the claimant were still living together well past the breakdown of the relationship. There was one woman, she was seeking an interim barring order. She told the court through a translator that she'd been living with her former partner now for 2 years during intense psychological and financial abuse. CEO of Safe Ireland, Mary McDermott, was able to tell me more.
The generalised problem of lack of housing stock is one issue that's well known. However, in the context of domestic violence, it is particularly troublesome because we have a system in Ireland where we don't count domestic violence victims as homeless. When they present to the local county council, they are not counted. They are not included in homeless figures, and therefore the services available to homeless people are not provided for them. And we have knock-on effects within our own frontline services as a result of that. We have people who are in refuge sometimes for over a year with their children. To trap people in a cul-de-sac is not the way to support them out of abuse.
On the point then of social housing, I spoke with a legal expert earlier who mentioned to me that if either party leave the social housing home, then they need to wait 3 years before they're put on a list to get their own home. Is that correct?
Well, yes, but again, it isn't just people in social housing. So, for example, the tenancy, the status of the tenancy may be changed and shifted and people dropped back down along a line for social housing. But this is also true for private housing. When it comes to victims who have a mortgage, for example, or a shared mortgage, they also will be in a bound situation. So what you have at a high level is that domestic violence victims are kept on a hamster wheel. So your listeners would have to kind of have the imagination to understand how stressed and how far down the line one would have to be in an abusive relationship to apply for a barring order. Because they know themselves that once they make a move to report, their danger and threat increases exponentially.
Just one thing I've learned this week, you know, from talking to people and even reading some of the emails that we've received from listeners over the past number of days, how difficult it is for them to actually do this, you know, and engage with this process. And, you know, I think it's such a reflection of, I suppose, how people are at the end of their tether totally, that they, you know, even to be able to do this in the first instance, it is a hard thing to do. But you sat in on the hearing, Sarah. There was obviously petitioners and respondents that were there present at the time. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was very tense. It was really tense. It was really emotional in some cases as well. At that point, you may have representation. So some people will have arrived with their solicitors. And even then, there were outbursts in the court. One man screamed at his former partner while she was in the witness box that she was a liar. You know, both the judge and the solicitor had to silence him. But a number of the hearings were actually struck out, Andrea, because the petitioner didn't show up. It's just like you were saying there, it's such a difficult process to engage with. And sometimes the petitioner, by the time the hearing date actually comes, will have just lost their nerve. The couple may have gotten back together. They may have reconciled. We all know how difficult it is to extricate yourself from an abusive relationship. But also clerks and court officials told me that they think that when pressure is exerted or when the respondent goes to the point of threatening the other person, instead of calling the police, the applicant will just drop everything. So this is a real issue, actually, when it comes to domestic violence law. And so, too, is the potential for re-victimisation in the hearing setting. I just mentioned there, you know, abuse in the presence of the judge and the solicitor. So what's happening outside of those doors? But I'm personally really troubled by the fact that none of this goes on a person's record. So unless a person, a respondent, breaches the order, there's no way of knowing they have a history of this kind. So anyone could unknowingly get into a relationship with someone mm-hmm. who has multiple orders against them from a number of people. Now, there are those out there who are looking to change that.
That's right.
And other components, of course, of domestic violence law. I spoke with Louise Crowley. She is professor in family law in the School of Law at UCC.
Domestic violence has always leaned on what we call civil remedies. So the abused person is the individual who needs to pursue the matter, needs to go to court and needs to seek the remedy. Whereas if similar abuse was happening on the streets between strangers, it would be a criminal assault. So that's really problematic. In more recent years, the guards have developed a pro-arrest policy, which means that the behaviour is also being recognised as criminal. So we are moving away from just depending on civil orders. And the guards have finally, after many years of controversy, realised the significance of domestic violence and recognised it as a criminal action. Additionally, we now have the criminal offence of coercive control, which is the first time domestic violence behaviour has been criminalised. My own view is that we should follow other countries who have recognised domestic violence as a criminal offence in itself, which removes that civil veil that prevents people from knowing that these orders have been granted. And I think that would be a really important step. And additionally, it's really important that the state, through its laws, recognises that abuse in the home is no less than abuse on the street. And so perhaps we should never have relied upon the individual to pursue their own remedy, that if somebody is assaulted in the home or subject to any form of abuse, that that should be immediately a criminal matter. And I think that that is something the Istanbul Convention has called on Ireland to do, to remedy the situation, to criminalise all acts of domestic abuse so that we have it on the record and someone does have a criminal record from those offences.
Yeah, Professor Louise Crowley there from the School of Law at UCC. Just one other point I wanted to ask you about, because it was mentioned by many of our listeners this week, you know, getting in touch, as I said, by email. The actual courthouse or building itself, you know, how comfortable is that?
I wouldn't say it's very comfortable at all. And that's from the perspective of someone who's in there in a purely professional sense, who isn't going through the system themselves. Now, I will say all of the court officials, the judges, the clerks, you know, even the Gardaí who worked there, they were all incredibly lovely. They were, you know, really kind and going out of their way to make the people feel comfortable who were there. But the building itself, in my opinion, it's not fit for purpose. I would almost go as far to say that it's not safe. You know, victims and abusers, they're in a shared waiting area. There's lots of nooks and crannies. It's just like an office building. You know, there's a door opens here to come into a small hallway. And then, you know, there's a corner here where you come out of the bathroom that you could get stuck in. And I actually had solicitors who work in that building telling me that they themselves had been intimidated by respondents in these unmanned hallways. So who's to say how applicants themselves are being treated?
People might feel. Sarah, listen, thank you very much for spending your days there down at the Family Law Courts. And just really interesting to, I think, bring listeners on, just give them a little bit of an insight into really what we've been talking about here over the past number of days. Sarah Madden, of course, News Talk reporter. If you or somebody you know has been affected, you know, by anything Sarah and I have been talking about today, there is help available. It's womensaid.ie, of course, the website. Their own helpline number is 1800 341 900. And I just want to give out the Samaritans as well. They too have a 24-hour helpline. That's 1161 23. If you want to share your own story, you can drop us an email. That's lunchtimelive@newstalk.com. Sarah Madden, thanks for joining us.
Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan. Weekdays at midday on News Talk. Conversation that counts.